I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more interesting books I've read this season is the latest from Ruby McConnell, Ground Truth, A Geological Survey of a Life. It's a timely book, not just because of living through the COVID-19 crisis, but today, the 18th of May, 2020, is the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. As Ms. McConnell writes in her book, that set off a decades-long struggle that reverberates today regarding resources, land use, and economics in the Pacific Northwest. To say that this part of the world, in southwest Washington into Oregon, even going up north to here in British Columbia, was affected would be an understatement. In the book, Ruby examines her life in the Pacific Northwest, where she grew up and her eventual study. She's a registered geologist, and I'll ask her about the trajectory of her life from 40 years ago to today. The book is also a marvelous memoir that paints a portrait of the landscape and the people of this land, not to mention the wild, the animals, and living species that she has observed along the way. It's an evocative book as she describes the outdoors and its complexity. Ruby McConnell is a writer who has received many honors, including the Literary Arts Oregon Literary Fellowship. She has written two previous books, A Girl's Guide to the Wild and A Woman's Guide to the Wild, which she was first on the program with in 2016. The website for more is at rubymcconnell.com. The Twitter handle is at RubyGoneWild. This new book is published by Overcup Press. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Ruby McConnell. Ms. McConnell, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're the author of this book, and we were just chatting before we started about how I felt about the book and what I got out of it. How would you describe this to someone who's listening to us, who hasn't picked it up yet, but who we hope will, about what's in it? Because, I mean, the word geological sounds like, and this is what I assumed when I got the book, that it was going to be a science book. I mean, it is in a way, but it isn't.
Right. So how I describe Ground Truth is part memoir and part ode to the Pacific Northwest. But fundamentally, it's probably closest in resemblance to what I'm sort of calling post-millennial environmentalism, which is storytelling that is wrapped in science communication and that is rooted in the intersection between human experience and the natural world.
I was going to ask you later, but this is a good place to bring it up, about your environmentalism, because you talk about that in the book, about how it seems to me that it is something that came to you very naturally. That it was inevitable living in this part of the world. You also talk about the sort of the differences in environmentalism that we see, that there are some that think that, you know, that it is possible to turn the ship around, if you will, and that it'll get better. I guess, are you in the camp that believes that the time for repair, the time for restoration, that has passed?
I think that there are fundamental changes to our environment affected by humans that we cannot reverse. I don't think that all of the changes that we have affected on the natural world are irreversible, mm-hmm. and I don't know that all of those changes need to be, but I do think that we are in an age of consequence.
And if we don't heed that, I mean, I guess catastrophe is just around the corner, isn't it?
I think catastrophe has arrived.
Mm.
I think that we are living through, in this very moment, I think that pandemics are a part of climate change.
Uh-huh.
It's indicative of evolution, of worldwide biological evolution of all sorts of kinds of species and adaptation to, you know, changes in the natural world.
And so you write about that in the book, and I have to say, I don't know if it surprises me, but it's not a cynical book, and it's not an unhopeful book, that you are someone who still has hope.
Absolutely.
And how do you retain that hope when there are so many people that think unlike you?
Well, I am hopeful, and I'm hopeful because I understand that, and I think because of geology, you know, we take a long view in geology.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that the Earth is billions of years old, and that in that time, many catastrophes have happened, and many dominant species have risen and fallen and disappeared and changed and adapted, and many have endured. I think that when you have that long view, it's easier to say some of these things will persist beyond us. The volcanoes will persist beyond us. The atmosphere will likely persist beyond us. Cockroaches will live through everything. And in fact, the resilience that we see from trees that have stood for 2,000 years, we may in fact find in ourselves. And I think that that's where my hope is. And I'm aware of being able to change my own behavior, and I'm aware of having control over my own choices. So I know and have faith in the ability of other people to do that as well.
And that's what this message that comes through the book. I mean, it's just beautifully rendered in a number of the pieces in the book. And I would urge people listening just to pick up the book for that. You write early in the book that geology is a lot of guesswork, and I'm wondering can that, I guess, there is an element of faith in that, isn't there?
Of pardon?
Of faith?
Faith? There's absolutely an element of faith. I think is part of what led me to study geology, that concept of some of this is faith-based. That you had to sort of go into a geology class and suspend your disbelief and be able to imagine things. And then you also have to come to it with a real acceptance of forces that are greater than ourselves. And I think that that is something that humans really struggle with. From the beginning when we thought we were sort of the center of the universe,
uh-huh.
If you have that concept of the natural world and yourself being the center of it, even if you let go of maybe being the center, you might not let go of how much influence or control you might have over it. And I think that as a species, we kind of struggle with acknowledging where we don't have that control. And also in letting go and trusting that the systems will sustain us. It goes both ways.
Yeah. There's also a sense of history that is throughout this book. And you get that sense right at the beginning of the book with the land acknowledgments. They're common up here in Vancouver. I mean, our health minister, when he does his daily COVID briefing, does that at the beginning. Our mayor. I don't get up early enough to hear Trudeau, but I'm sure. That's something I've heard him do in other instances. Are land acknowledgments, are they common in the United States? Or
they're becoming more common. I will say that when I do events and I do land acknowledgments, I refer the people in the audience to a Canadian website, native-land.ca,
mm-hmm.
which is the best resource for international Indigenous land information that I've ever found. So I think that Canada's way ahead of it
yeah.
by virtue of that alone. But it is becoming more common. I suspect that there's going to be some rollback to that. The current time that we're in right now, I don't see Americans taking good care of our Indigenous people through the pandemic. And I think that will have reverberations.
Yeah.
In the near future for us, relationship.
The Oscars earlier this year, which is now seems like 10 years ago now in some minds, I think featured one somewhere in the broadcast, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What one of the things that I guess it's on the cover of the book is Mount St. Helens. So that's something that I guess my preconception of the book was that it was going to be about what happened 40 years ago. And you do discuss that throughout the book because it is something that is factored in your life. I'd like to talk about sort of the impact of what happened 40 years ago there and what happened to the region, because you describe that in the book. And, you know, when I read of, say, the economic implications, for example, it sounds awfully familiar to what we're going through today.
You know, I think that you're exactly right in that there's a lot to reflect upon in the Mount St. Helens eruption experience of 1980 and the pandemic now, especially when we look at issues of science communication and policy setting and the communication of safety and probabilities related to safety. You know, there was an evacuation zone around a beloved recreational area, and it was not just a recreational area. It was, you know, logging. They had to shut down logging operations, so a lot of jobs were lost. It was fishing and hunting in a time when many people still fed their families to some degree in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of things that political and social implications for that, you know, evacuation zone. And then the fact that it went on over time, and you saw sort of a rise and fall of interest and people who were drawn to the danger as time went past. So you got sort of volcano tourism,
mm-hmm.
and that became an issue as people put themselves in harm's way. And then you got the people who refused to believe, you know. So we lost some people who lived on the mountain who, you know, couldn't sort of reconcile themselves to what turned out to be an eventuality. I think it is a really interesting sort of microcosm to consider our own situation now from.
Yeah. What are you thinking about personally at this time when we're marking the 40th anniversary of the eruption?
I am thinking a lot about expectations and, you know, especially around my own expectations of what, you know, I did some returning to Mount St. Helens over time, and sort of my own expectations for, you know, how future things play out.
Mm-hmm.
And failures of imagination, I guess, would be a better way of putting it. You know, a lot of, we lost a good young geologist, David Johnston, up at Johnston Ridge in 1980, and scientists who were there say that was largely due to a failure of imagination. They didn't imagine the lateral blast, and so they had positioned him someplace that ended up not being safe because their image had been of a volcano that would erupt up, not
right.
out.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking a lot about, like, what are our expectations? And what are our underlying assumptions, and what are we setting ourselves up for in this time? And then I'm also thinking a lot about resilience. The recovery at Mount St. Helens, you know, it was described as a devastated landscape.
Right.
But really, there's been a rapid and startling and beautiful recovery of the ecosystem there. It's really startling over 40 years. And I think that that is the thing that I cling to the most, is sort of that concept of abiding resilience.
And how is science today in terms predicting something like this happening again? I mean, it could happen again, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's still active. In fact, Mount St. Helens is still steaming. There's still a dome growing. Mount Rainier, the entire Cascade Volcanic Belt all the way up into Alaska is active. Yeah, I mean, you just sort of, they're still being monitored, and you keep an eye on it. You know, you come to a place of acceptable risk. You know, we do this with vehicles, we do this with airplanes.
Uh-huh.
So in 1980, the eruption of the volcano was a novelty. But after 40 years, we've grown used to the concept of having this in our backyard.
Mm.
And so we've sort of assigned it an acceptable level of risk because it's been pretty predictable. In terms of predicting when it's going to come up again, we don't get a lot of warning. There's monitoring, mm-hmm. and that's great, and that will give you some degree of warning. But really, you know, predictive science is really a difficult game to play, and I think that responsible scientists are reticent to do so. You know, I mean, weather people are really brave to every day stand up on television and make a scientific prediction.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so you consider, like, consider how much data, you know, weather people have and how familiar these patterns are and how easy it is, you know, to look out and kind of predict the weather yourself and then consider how often they're incorrect.
Yeah.
And that tells you right there how difficult it is to predict a natural system.
And then they get the ire of their listeners or their viewers if it's wrong. And then I guess that's why we're seeing a lot of people mistrust science now. Because I think there is a reliance on it and I guess a demand that it be accurate and right, and quickly.
And quickly.
But it obviously can't, right?
Sometimes it can. You know, it's amazing, but often it can't, more importantly, it probably shouldn't. And for no other reason than you really do want to give, you know, smart people time to think and time to process and the time to compile the right data and make sure that you're even asking the right question.
Mm. Right. We've grown up in this part of the world. I'm talking from Vancouver. You're in Oregon. Bracing for the big one, you know, a huge earthquake. What is the relationship between, say, volcanoes and earthquakes?
The relationship on the west coast of the North American continent is largely a direct relationship. So it's the same subduction of the Pacific plate, the oceanic plate, under the lighter, less dense North American plate. It's that same collision that causes the earthquakes as causes the line of volcanoes. So eventually what happens is that subducting plate melts and starts to release water and magma. Those kinds of blobs of magma rise up and cook through the crust, and that's where we get volcanoes.
Mm. And that's the other thing that I was thinking about as reading the book, because there's something you wrote, I'm trying to find it in my notes here, where we have a sort of vertical self-perception. This is what you wrote in the book, and how the Pacific Northwest was shaped is horizontally, and we overlook that, don't we?
We do, because the volcanoes run north-south, and the valleys then, because of that, run north-south, and then the coast, you know, mountains run north-south also because of that rumbling of that collision. But the collision is really sort of an east-west trending collision. And so we get this linearity, and we get this north-south, probably also accentuated by country boundaries and cultural boundaries,
yeah, yeah.
You know, that are related to that. But really, the primary dominant forces that are creating our landscape and our geologic hazards as well are these east-west collisional forces. And that's sort of, you know, one of, for me, the joys and interesting things of geology is the way that things get flipped. Our experience of something is because of, you know, the opposite forces at work.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other, the fascinating part about the book is when you talk about these narratives that come up through history, your own personal history even, and, you know, you write in the book about your family that you were the youngest of three children, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And right away when someone says that there were three siblings, one assumes the fate is not the right word, but sort of what it was like growing up for all three of the children already. I mean, you're the youngest, so we assume, you know, traits to you that we would not assume to someone who's the middle child or the older child. When you think about the narratives of your own growing up, say, are those true in terms of how one's life turns out, say? I mean, do you believe that? I mean, the other thing I should mention is that I guess as the youngest child, and there was a number of years between each child, I guess you were unexpected. Is that correct?
I think I was unexpected. I don't know that my mother would like me to say that in public, but I think I was. I think that how she has described it to me was a pleasant surprise.
There you go.
She was told it wouldn't happen.
Yeah. And that makes sense. So
right.
I mean, when because that's something that you've contended with throughout this book are these narratives that come up, and I'm wondering your thoughts about how one's life is shaped by what's being said around them. Say,
and I think that might have been sort of the central question that I was investigating in the process of writing this book. Even was here are these narratives, you know. So you're born a youngest child. You know, there's three girls, you're a girl in sort of a middle-class family in the United States, so what is your life supposed to look like? You know, like, how are you supposed to grow up? What are you supposed to be? And, you know, those narratives didn't fit me for the most part. And I just took this really different path, and I think a lot of that was because my parents really didn't impose narratives on me.
Mm-hmm.
They really allowed me to really fundamentally be my own person and celebrated that person. And they did that of my sisters as well. You know, the message from my parents was always, you are always welcome home. You can always come home to us. No matter what you have done or what has happened or who you become, you can always come home. And I think that that message is so powerful in finding yourself.
Is that message also something that we can ascribe to this place, the Pacific Northwest?
I would like to think so. I think that the land always welcomes us. I think that the land is I think that the land of the Pacific Northwest is an incredibly protective place. I think that the rain is protective. I think that the mountains are protective. I think that the forests can help heal you in this place. I think that the Pacific Northwest in particular has a long history, particularly in Oregon and in the United States, I can't speak for Canada, of colonialism and exclusion and detainment
mm-hmm.
that needs to be addressed before everyone who is from this place or wants to call this place home can feel that way. And I just think it's unresolved.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned a moment ago about how healing nature can be, the outdoors. If nature can heal us or reward us, can it also punish us, do you think?
You know, that's an interesting and intriguing question. I like to... I was raised Catholic and tend to not resonate with even those kinds of notions of punishment, I think, in response to my Catholic upbringing. running counter to that, I think that and so I'm inclined through my own personal bias to say no. However, does that mean that we are without consequence? No.
And then also,
I think there's also that the randomness of the world that we would like to interpret as punishment that sometimes just, you know, is that you're small potatoes and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time in terms of the universe, cosmically speaking. So I think it all kind of gets muddled. But I think that overall, you know, ultimately it's the land that sustains humans just like any other life form. And so it can only really nourish us to the best of its ability.
The other thing that I, because I am in Vancouver, and, you know, you describe, you know, you and your partner going up to Bellingham, for example. It's quite close to the border here, and so, you know, that's a part of the of Washington that I know, and you know, I've done the Amtrak thing from here to all the way to Portland. So what you describe in the book is familiar. When you talk about this part of the world, the idea that it could be, I don't know, destroyed is the right word, but it could be, you know, that it could get unprotected one day. I mean, that's something that I guess not only climate change has brought on that urgency, hasn't it?
Right. I mean, we could just devour it with subdivision. We could completely strip it with mines. We can shave the trees off the land. Humans are just as good at knocking down trees as volcanoes are. We can strip it of its fish. I think that there's just a lot of ways that we can lose the land. I think we can lose it due to erosion, and often human-caused erosion. And I think, too, we can lose it by losing a sense of our unique cultural heritage that's connected to the ways we used to live when we were a little bit decommodified and a little less monocultured. You know, I think that there's a flavor to how people lived here that we could also lose track of in our push to globalize.
Yeah, I think that's the point that I wanted to stress as we were chatting, that even though it is special, it is protected, it is tenuous, as I guess all of life is, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's fleeting. And I think that, you know, part of my goal in Ground Truth was to tell some stories. And, you know, in the Irish tradition of storytelling, wherein we want to, you know, keep the history of the place alive in our stories. It's not just our own personal stories, but we're aware of the fact of sort of maintaining a larger cultural, historical story in that tradition. And I think that, you know, the Pacific Northwest is a special enough place to have that kind of long-standing cultural and storytelling tradition attached to it. And I think it has for people who have lived here for many, many hundreds of years.
That's the other thing that I wanted to bring up was because a lot of us, not just in the United States but in Canada, live close to city centers. Those of us that are lucky enough to live in the Pacific Northwest, I guess don't realize what's out there and what's so close to where we live in the various cities that we live in. That's something you brought up in the book, that we don't just realize just how beautiful and magical and majestic the outdoors are and so close to where we live.
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about that particularly as, you know, I watch the world be put in place, you know, and when we think about sort of reopening and as we venture out into the world and how grateful I am to live in a place that has elbow room and that has places that the people can spread out to, even in the more populated places like Seattle and Portland and Vancouver, you know, where you are, that we have these places that are so accessible. And I feel really hopeful that people will take this as an opportunity to use those places in a way that we've maybe let go of in the last generation or two.
Yeah.
And really look at it as a place of refuge and solitude and necessary space.
When you say that, I mean, one can't help but be hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that our hope lies in the fact that we can do that.
Indeed. What has this time of COVID been for you personally? What have your living circumstances been like? I mean, are you able to get out and see nature as it is wherever you are?
I am. I feel extraordinarily lucky. I was already working from home. My husband was already working mostly from home. We live in Eugene, which is a small city at best.
Uh-huh.
So we are, you know, blessed with many parks and many open spaces. The infrastructure of the city itself, we have a large backyard. So I've been doing a lot of gardening, a lot of putting in of you know, foodstuffs and medicines and just sort of spending time in my home space wilderness, which I encourage people to really embrace.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also, you know, drive 20 minutes and be at a forest road rather than a trailhead. I have been able to spend a lot of time outside, but I have also been really aware of trying not to go to hiking trails and instead using places where if I encounter other people, I'm on a much broader path and can give people their space and try to use those places that are maybe less utilized, although still close and safe.
So we're speaking on the 40th anniversary of the eruption at Mount St. Helens, and you write early in the book about how the course of your life has been shaped by events 40 years ago. You also write throughout the book about wanting to question that narrative. After having written this book and having it now published, the relationship between you and what happened 40 years ago, I mean, what is that today especially?
I think that for me personally, the eruption of Mount St. Helens put into motion the sequence of events that led me to my course of study. I know for a fact that I would not have become a geologist if Mount St. Helens had not erupted in 1980. That was the opportunity that I was given as a young person to make the leap into that particular science. And from there, from that moment, that decision to become a geologist and change my course of study, I can sort of see a domino effect of how I arrived to where I am, and having, most importantly, the experience of the American West and the knowledge base to do the kind of writing that I'm currently doing. If I hadn't been given that first Mount St. Helens project, I wouldn't have the skill set to do the kind of writing that I'm so passionate about now.
The other thing that this book makes me think about as I'm reading it is, as you mentioned a moment ago, you talk about places throughout the region that you've been over the years. It makes me wonder when I can go to Bellingham again or Portland or Seattle. And, you know, if I guess if I can't in the interim, I can take my memories of times there and I guess supplement it with your perspective, because it makes it a lot richer, and it won't just be a vacation next time, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I encourage people to travel in that way with a deep curiosity and a sense of wonder that I feel when I look at the natural world that I think is really honed in geology and a field eye. But I think that particularly as we try to navigate, you know, traveling will probably start in these sort of shorter distances.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that we're going to need to travel in a different style and pay, I think, closer and deeper attention to the places that we do get to visit and really get as much as we can out of them.
This is, I could talk all afternoon with you about this book, because there's so many parts of the book that I enjoyed and that intrigued me, that interested me. I hope for people listening to us that we've given them a sense of what's in the book so that they pick it up for themselves, because I think if they're like me, they'll get something out of it that they didn't expect, and because of that, they'll enjoy the experience of reading it. Ruby, congratulations on this book, and good luck with it. I hope it does well, and I hope that people do pick it up. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
The book is called Ground Truth, A Geological Survey of a Life. It's published by Overcup Press. Visit rubymcconnell.com for more information. Ruby McConnell joined me on the line from Eugene, Oregon, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.